It's really nice to come here because what's so astonishing to me is the incredible different perspectives we can all have on one system, right? It's just astonishing, just from the few talks that I've seen here, but also online, how the variability of just taking one system and looking at it from so many different perspectives is quite astonishing. And so to even make it even more confusing, I'm going to mix a few things in my talk today that link with both biology and technology. So I'm going to see whether what the links can be, and maybe try and get a two-way discussion going on some things that we build in terms of a measure. So we're going to try and, can we characterize spatiotemporal patterns with a type of information measure? And I should say, first of all, this is work with Manuel Sanchez Montanez, Universidad Autónoma Madrid. He did sort of theoretical work with me on basically trying to make a measure for spatiotemporal patterns. And basically, we can see how we can try and use this to build electronic noses. Can we make better electronic noses using these types of measures? And also, along the way, I think it's important to try to link this with the biology. So I'll try to see at various points, as best as I can, connect with what I know about the biological system. So as we know, when we drink our, say, coffee this morning or beer from Bass Breweries, we have, which is actually much more chemically complex, has about 1,000 different chemicals for some types of beers, except not Budweiser beer, which is very chemically simple. But like British beers and newer American beers, were incredibly good actually, have, you know, very chemically complex, right? So they have hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals that are all mixed up, all of many different types, landing on the olfactory mucosa and the epithelium.
So does Budweiser actually have fewer chemicals?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and it's also what's
it, actually.
Yeah, it is. There's a very nice paper that actually looked at different types of pilsners and stuff. I can give it to you. That looks at the not only the total number of chemicals, but it's also important which ones stand out, right? So crazy companies like I don't know, the ones that make this Sunny Delight orange juice. They try to take the complexity of orange juice and reduce it down to a number of key compounds that would be kind of make the percept of an orange juice. And they try to get it down to like 9 or 10 chemicals or something. And with Budweiser beer, you could probably reduce it to one chemical. No. You can. No. But it comes out as a handful of like maybe 20, 30 important, you know, profiles that come out to characterize that, and you know, more complex than there might be more ones that stand out, and the balance of them is more important, and so on. So it is the chemistry of brewery is mind-bogglingly complex, right? So we've got this olfactory mucosa sheet, we've got this basically convolution of all these compounds, and how do we think about it? So following both Peter and Alex, we're going to start in a similar way, really, which is a little bit reassuring that all the theories I've seen so far have started in a similar vein in terms of trying to characterize this. So, you know, we've got our different molecules. These could be individual molecules, or they could be stimulus symbols, but for the purposes of this talk, it's going to be more useful to think about them as individual molecules that create some space. This would be the concentration of this space. And so, for example, then, very obviously, a mixture will be some subspace of this total space. So B would be a mixture between these two. A binary mixture, this would be another binary mixture on this plane. And C would be some mixture of the three in some way, right? And if we consider this at least linearly, we can think about putting these mixtures onto the receptor sheet together. We know that if we put individual ones of these, we get a particular receptor tuning across a population, so we get some population code for the other compound, another population code. And of course, in terms of the internal representation, we can think about this, if we consider this a linear system, which a lot of us have been doing, and there's maybe good support up to some limit within some range, that this may be a reasonable assumption, that we have some linear transformation of these spaces. Now, as it was pointed out before, because of the number of receptors and the number of possible tunings and so on, there's this huge null space of this. And if you just take, for argument's sake, there's at least 10,000 ligands, I think we said yesterday, could be well more, could be hundreds of thousands possible ligands. We know there are 1,000 OR tunings, and so just even considering this as a binary code, we get some ridiculous number of possible activation patterns. That basically comes to like the number of atoms in the universe or something, right? So we do need clearly some very simplifying rules to reduce this down onto some manifold or something like this, otherwise the whole thing just is not tractable. So there have to be some simplifying rules to make this system work in any way that's reasonable, but that's not really what we're going to talk about precisely, because we're going to make it even more complex by adding time. But we know that the biological system solves this by having a receptor repertoire that is both a mixture of very broadly and more specifically tuned receptors. So this is just the spiking rate, very old data from 1984 paper with Seeker and Holly in the frog nose, where the spot size is showing you the receptor activity. And obviously, as we change the concentration, we would get more of these becoming active. But at any particular behaviorally relevant concentration, we would have sort of more specific and less specific. So it seems to be, a long time ago, everyone was talking about olfaction was totally broadly tuned, but in fact, it seems much more important to mix both broadly tuned receptors, responses, with much more specific ones. So it seems that the olfactory system is using this combination of both.
Sorry, highly specific. Sorry, the numbers, they are non-receptors or just units, measure units, in the previous one?
In the previous one,
it's 1984.
Just all these numbers.
These numbers, these are just random cell numbers taken from
it. You know they were receptors, right? I mean, it's 1984. Yes. Just picked up. By the way, do you know if they... So did anybody ever ask the Holly for the original data? I know this is 84, so they probably never published it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I wonder if it still exists. So, you know, recent, much more comprehensive studies have shown a similar story. Okay, so to start with, how can we characterize this? We'll just ignore time.
Question, since you made the point that older figure, you know, is pre our knowledge of receptors, does knowing the receptors help at all?
Does knowing which is which?
Sorry, I mean, this is a heretical question.
Yes, it is.
But,
the Nobel Prize especially, right?
Well, no.
I agree. It's a great question.
So, for example, do we know that if I grabbed two olfactory receptor neurons that express the same receptor, I would actually see the same pattern, or is that just a widely held belief?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? We don't know necessarily how reproducible. Has anyone studied reproducibility of these receptor responses across...
They're not totally visible, but there are a few papers, right? I mean, the one mammalian receptors that's cited a lot is the Stuart Firestein and Ricardo Aronieta, mm-hmm. and this thing where they did, I think they just made systematic mutations and tests of ligands, and Peter Bombart, of course, is the one who did a lot of mutations, but more for development,
yeah.
where it goes. So the feeling, I think, is that you can get similar responses, but it depends on where you make the mutation, right? If it's a ligand binding pocket, doesn't work.
And is is there any, we know something about the structures of receptors, but not much, right?
So yeah, right, that's it. That's definitely where Stuart Feierstein's stuff comes in, right? So they've taken, I mean, it's very difficult to do, but that they've been able to take just one or two of the receptor structures, look at the secondary folding structure and try to understand with classes of molecules how it interacts. So there are a few nice papers on that. But of course it's highly restricted, right? We might only know that for one or two receptor classes and then only a few molecules. So
I believe a single ORN is about 2 orders of magnitude dynamic range. But if you combine all the ORNs, it's about 4, right? Is that the at least some variability within a class, right? At least in when it turns on.
Yeah, I mean, thinking there is probably about the degree of expression, how many sites are expressed to give a kind of population.
We know that's not just
same.
Geometry. Some of them get more access to the order.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. People know why. But the real question is, if you take two RNs of the same receptor type and show a lot of odors and see if they're the same, right? Has that ever been done?
Yes.
And they're pretty similar.
Yeah, I don't want to distract you too much. You should ask stoppers whenever. So there again is a paper by Menghan Ma, which is somewhat controversial, where they took M71 as identified receptor in a slice and basically did this exactly, this concentration curves, and the claim was heretical, was that it's very different. You can have, as Peter is saying, I think at least 2 orders of magnitude difference at the exact same receptor. Neurons expressing the same receptor, different neuron, different OSNs.
There's certainly no in insects, and also another very interesting aspect. Yeah, another really interesting aspect of this in insects is that each of the receptors, even though they, each of the neurons, even though they express the same receptor, have radically different time properties, right? So they're almost like little filters on different parts of a plume, because they have different temporal characteristics, presumably by the ion channels and other mechanisms within the cell, but it's almost like they're acting as different temporal filters, but that's kind of another story. I'm not sure how relevant that is to
manage. There's actually more about this, that you have the same sensibilia, you can have many different receptors expressed, and one of them interacts with the other one, so
yeah. It's
make the two cells that actually express the same receptors, we have a different pattern depending who is the neighboring cell.
Right, yeah. Okay, so could we at least theoretically try and get a handle on this, and first of all to ignore time, because that obviously complicates things. And using the same strategy as Peter and Alex, we'll consider basically a space of these like in my previous diagram. And the S's here could be stimuli, so they could be complex stimuli of an odor, like coffee or bacon or whatever we had was the favorite odor last week. Or for the purposes of this talk, it's going to turn out to be useful that these are chemicals, right? And we're going to consider them as chemicals, but they could be more complex things. And what we're going to look at, the approach we're interested in, is basically we've got obviously a bunch of stimulus space here, which is very highly dimensional. Then we have a receptor class repertoire, so these are our numbers of receptor classes we have, and this is a population code then of the highly dimensional stimulus, and obviously the fact that it's not reversible back to the stimulus precisely is due to the fact that we have some noise introduced to degrade the signal. If these were electronic sensors, this might be a Gaussian noise or something, and if it's a receptor, then there's maybe Poisson noise or some other type of noise shape. It could either be correlated or decorrelated between the channels and so on. So obviously as a function of this noise and also the tunings of these receptors to the stimulus space determines how accurately we would be able to basically reconstruct each one of these signals. And it turns out that there's, as you probably know already, there's a good way to do that, which is the Fisher information. Through the Fisher information allows us to estimate the best unbiased estimator to basically recover or reconstruct the original stimulus parameters. So basically, we would end up with some estimate of the stimulus, but with some error, and that error is what we're interested in between the original stimulus parameter and the reconstructed parameter. Now, certainly in terms of what the overall olfactory system doing, this is probably not this is probably unreasonable, right? Because it's not going to be interested in all of these. And it's probably interested in some function of this somehow. But for the purposes of just looking at the population code at the periphery, this could be a reasonable thing to at least set up. So basically, whatever the processing is subsequently to this at the mucosa, its performance is limited by its ability to accurately detect these individual compounds. So maybe as a starting assumption, it's not such a bad place to begin to set up the sensory system to have at least an accurately estimate of the original high-dimensional stimulus. And then the subsequent processing clearly does all sorts of things to throw away large amounts of this information, right, in different ways, which has been the subject of other talks. And really, for this one, we're going right back to basics and going to stick at the mucosa, because we're going to introduce time to this and just think about what's happening at the receptor surface. So I don't need to make any strong statements about basically what the subsequent processing might be throwing away. So the standard formulation for that is the Fisher information. So basically we have receptor response R, the stimulus. So basically we get a particular distribution of receptor responses or the noise in the receptor for a given high-dimensional stimulus. And we can construct a Fisher information matrix, which basically for two components of the stimulus, so this would be one dimension, this would be another dimension, and so I and J are the two dimensions, but basically can construct the matrix then across all the stimuli, which is square, if it has good properties, we can invert it. And the key result that probably most people know already is the Kramer-Rao bound that tells us that if we invert this matrix and look at the diagonals, then basically the diagonals of the inverse of this tells us the best unbiased estimator that we can build. And basically this error, to tell us the variance of the error between the best unbiased estimator we can build for that particular dimension. So this is the reconstruction error that tells us how accurately, in principle, given the noise and given the tuning, so you've got a number of things that are built in here, the tuning and the noise, which has to contribute to this ability to reconstruct the stimulus. One of the nice properties of this measure is that it has very close relationships to psychophysics, because this variance is something related maybe to the just noticeable difference, or JND, in psychophysics that we think about maybe. So one of the nice appealing things of this is that we might be able to link it with psychophysics and behavior in some way, or test it in some sense. And although we've emphasized here the reconstruction error on the ability to the variance on estimating the exact stimulus, we can also link this quite usefully, look at Dayan and Abbott's book, with discriminability between a stimulus and a change in the stimulus. If we compute this, it will tell us, or if we optimize this Fisher matrix, we can then optimize discriminability between two points in that space. Okay, so with these links, so we basically were going to optimize this, but it have these links that might be useful later, right? So just to give you an intuition, what does this actually do? We'll take a very simple case where imagine that the noise on the receptor is just Gaussian, and it's Gaussian for all stimuli, so over the tuning curve, stays as a Gaussian. And we'll also consider that the tuning curve itself is a sort of Gaussian. So if we have a stimulus like this with a Gaussian tuning curve, the noise on the receptor is also Gaussian with these lines, then the formula just reduces to this, which variance of the Gaussian noise.
It's independent Gaussian.
Sorry?
Independent Gaussian.
Yeah, independent. And then basically the square of the gradient of this tuning curve, which is very intuitive, because if the noise is the same everywhere, we would obviously get maximum information or the maximum bang per buck of this change in stimulus to neural response would be at these points. And at the top, at the top we would have no Fisher information because we don't have any change in the receptor response. So it reduces to this simple form. So this is capturing, so it gives you the intuition, this is capturing both, but obviously if we change these noise properties, this no longer holds, right? But it gives you the intuition of how the noise, it's clearly important that both the noise and the tuning both have to contribute and be related to each other, and that's basically what the Fisher information is doing.
Tim, I'm not giving you a good intuition on how you would change the x-axis like that. I mean, you plot it as a stimulus.
So this has got nothing to do with olfaction, by the way. So this is just an example. So this is certainly not an olfactory neuron or whatever.
Well, you could think it's a single, that's the concentrations and chemical on the x-axis, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean,
tuning curves are sigmoidal, not.
Yeah, I mean, I would have.
But you can replace that by a sigmoidal tuning curve. You get the exact same thing, right? It's
the same story.
You know, the point of the thing is that it's just not clear other than the concentration.
Yeah, I mean, you just take this part, right? It's the same thing. So just for that part. But yeah, I mean, we're not trying to link at this point with a olfactory tuning curve or whatever. Right? Just to illustrate. So we did the same thing as I think Peter did. Let's go back, just describe this as a linear thing, right? So we go back, we've got some tuning parameters, so our receptor R is some linear function of these dimensions, so we'll call those A. Those could be the affinities, for example, or, like we saw yesterday, they could be learned parameters to the affinities, so within the cell or something like this, but they're basically some sensitivity parameters to the individual compounds. Okay, we need some noise, and we'll have a baseline spontaneous firing. So an individual neuron response will be our set of tunings. Either these are learnt, or they're defined by affinities or efficacy or whatever for some OSN cell parameter. We have a baseline spontaneous firing. We need a noise process to degrade. So we could change this formulation, either it could be Poisson noise, Gaussian noise, whatever. But we just wanted to play a game, first of all, as a basic reality check. What would happen if we optimize this with the Fisher information and vary these A parameters? We want to know what type of tunings is a good tuning for this high-dimensional stimulus. So if we consider high-dimensional stimuli, how should we arrange these tunings to get the best reconstruction error, or the minimum reconstruction error. And you can probably see from the Fisher information, it would like these numbers to be as big as possible, right? Because more sensitivity, the better the information. So we do have to limit it somehow, because in reality, this is limited, obviously, by the maximum firing rate of the cell. This clearly cannot be infinite. So we limit this. We just limit A between 1 and minus 1. So we could have an inhibitory responses. And if we do that, let's just do that in...
considering independent noise?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, just on the basis that receptor responses are decorrelated or sensor, or also if you build electronic sensors, they tend to be. So we'll just play that game between, we'll have 100 receptors, and we'll have a nine-dimensional loaded universe. And what would the configuration of the sensors look like? So this is just one very typical optimized solution, where you see four have maximum positive and five have maximum negative. Yeah.
And you don't have any noise on the S?
But in some way that's bound up with the receptor noise, right? So you're sort of, you can...
But you don't multiply with the A, right?
I think
the solution you get is minus 1 plus 1.
Yeah, you could. It's a good question, if you wanted to. I mean, we're just interested in the mainly the noise in the neural system. But yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to consider what happens, for instance, in an animal where, you know, you've got some fluctuation in the stimulus as well. Be a good thing to do.
So I have a conceptual question. I think the Fisher information is local, right? And so it's about distinguishing two stimuli that are very close to each other.
Yeah.
But if I ask you, what's the best set of receptors to build, you might think that in order to answer that question, you have to tell me something about the range of odors that you're going to encounter. It's not local. So then you need something like, what, the average Fisher information over the set? I mean.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to integrate the Fisher information. We're going to have to say something about over all the stimulus, but that's kind of a nice property because it also means, because it's local, we can use the same measure to say we want to know the information at this point, or we have choices to, you know, take a marginal
so
or whatever.
I guess in showing us results, what did you actually do? I mean, you
this is the total. This is the total error. So we optimized across the total Fisher information across all the dimensions.
Sorry, the Fisher information is a function of S.
Yeah.
So what did you do? You moved S around, or are you?
In this case, it's independent of S, right?
No, I think we just took stimulus examples across all of the space within this 9D. And then optimize, because this basically we use the genetic algorithm
to
optimize.
Optimize the. I mean, if the dimensionalities of R and S are different, then it's a little funny, right? So, in the linear model. So,
Yeah, and
maybe it's simplified because it's linear?
Yeah, we had to take it across the whole space, so we just had examples of S.
So, go back to your question. For Fisher, isn't F is linear, so DFDS is A, right? No, that not the expression Fisher information. So DF is no, not that one. The 1D case. So it's just a bunch of 1D models, right? So DFDS is just the A's, right?
Yeah.
So if you sum an I of AI squared over sigma squared.
So in this case, just linear, yeah.
That's why you want all the A's to be smashed up against one.
No, but I think in the experiment we did what you said, which is to take different stimulus examples and then look at the error over the whole space.
But it looks like Fisher information should be independent of stimulus in this case.
It will be, yeah, in this case. Right? Yeah, I think you're right. Because we just have this linear. We just have this linear system. So it comes to a very simple form. So that's just one example tuning, but what about all the others? So basically we get a bunch of different configurations, but when you look at the population, what you find is you get, which is quite nicely matching with the biology, is you get most of them tend to have four or a fewer number with five, but a fewer number with three, and only a small number of these with a single positive tuning. So these are kind of the specific guys. There's only a few of those, but they're needed. We need the specific guys, and we also need the unspecific guys. So basically, we get a distribution which includes both specificity and non-specificity. So we get some of them that have just negative tunings to all of them and positive to one, or the other way around. But most of the responses are trying to cover more of the space.
But if you change the number of, so here you have nine receptors, right?
Yeah, this is just the this is just the number of positive.
It's more or less random what you get there or not.
Yeah. So in fact, what you've got here is a Poisson. So in fact, it turns out that you can create, which is an interesting point that comes out of this, you can create the optimal configuration by flipping a coin. Because if you flip a coin to each dimension, you get the optimal point, which great that you brought that up, because it's going to link with the stochastic gene expression, right? So maybe stochastic gene expression is a good way to actually build such a system.
Sorry, so in this linear, I'm going to obsess on this, but in this linear model, if the variances of the A to I's are all the same, which you didn't tell us, but probably, right? Then the Fisher information matrix is sort of the square of is the outer product of the A vectors or something. And so, like the A's themselves matrices, so it's the transpose of the matrix times itself, the indices in the right place, and that's the Fisher information matrix. You're worried about estimation along individual components, so then in that case it's the diagonal. So you're asking about the, and if you want to average over all the components, then it's the trace.
About them. Yeah, yeah.
And so you're asking about the trace of a matrix. You're trying to maximize the trace of the
inverse. Yeah. Yeah. You've got to take the inverse first. Yeah, because it's this, right?
Well, I could maximize the trace, right?
Well, that's for the discriminability, like this. But if you take the inverse, then you're this reconstruction.
Right. So I want to minimize the inverse, the trace of the inverse of this matrix, whose and it's. The matrix is the square of sort of the square of the A matrix, or the outer product of the matrix itself, and so, and you insist that the elements are bounded, so you end up with them hitting the bound.
They have to, otherwise it just
and
explodes.
Presumably, if you, since 100 is a big number, it doesn't really matter how you distribute the ones and minus ones, as long as they add up in some way. I don't know. I mean, it just seems like this is a problem that one would have some analytic insight in. I don't understand.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, well, sure. I'm not sure. It's beyond my math's ability to write down the equations of this, so that's why we simulated it. But quite possibly, this might give you more ideas, because when you look at we change the input dimension, because obviously, you know, does this depend, we're interested in much higher dimensionality, right? And so with our 100 receptors, as we increase the input dimensionality, which is the key thing, the number of different tuning curves we get matches the maximum possible, right? So it's like covering all of the kind of vertices of this space.
So I'm confused what you mean by different, by tuning curve in this. Tuning curves are the AIJs, right? And so they're the plus or minus one.
To the different compounds. So as we increase the dimensionality, we've got whether the vector of A's are the same or different.
Wait, hold on a second. So the vector of A's, that's the vector containing plus or minus ones. Oh, how different are these binary vectors?
Yeah, over as we increase the number of vertices. So we increase the number, we increase the space. We want to know, these are the red line is the maximum number of vertices we could have for different tunings with the vector of A's. And when we optimize the solution, how does this follow this? And it follows the maximum it can until obviously it maxes out. It only has 100 neurons. So it can only have a fixed number of different tunings. But basically...
So the y-axis is like the hamming distance
between these? No, the y-axis is just as we redo the optimization for different dimensions. And the red line is the theoretical limit on the number of different tunings you could have for that dimension.
Oh, so different means if it's difference by one component, it can be different.
Okay. Yeah. And similarly to that, as you might expect, as you increase the dimension, then the number of neurons with the same or with the different tunings, eventually we just get to one. So as we increase that, we get, basically, they want to cover the space as much as possible, and they want to diversify themselves as much as possible to get different varieties. And this is the reason why a sort of Poisson solution gives a good result, because you cover the whole space. One thing with the dimensionality, if we take the one thing that's interesting to do is if we take this optimal solution for this case that we've just optimized here, and let's compare with when we enforced only specific receptors. So like in an insect system, maybe this is like an insect where you have to only have specific receptors to, say, in a pheromone system. Well, there you have highly specific receptors. Compared to when you can have these overlapping receptors, how do you do with the error as the dimensionality increases? And the kind of nice result is that with this broad tuning and mixture of specific and non-specific, you grow linearly with the dimension. Whereas if you're forced into specific receptors, you sort of grow quadratically. Now, in a pheromone system, this may make sense, right? Because if we look down here, we've only got a few components we might be interested in for say, a moth, which is something else I study on. Some moths only use 3 or 4 components in their pheromone blend. And then, really, it doesn't make much difference down here, right? You're going to get similar ability to reconstruct or whatever. Whereas when we come for mammals or whatever, where we have to deal with very high dimensional stimuli, then this solution becomes worse and worse. So kind of obvious why we don't really want to use highly specific. So the ratio of the two is then, you know, just gets worse and worse with dimensionality, with the specific to unspecific solution. Now, we know that the receptor repertoire, you know, in rats, mice, or whatever, so we've got 1,000 of these different receptors, and I don't claim to be an expert on genetics, but there's a very interesting story that's evolving, still very active, in terms of how these genes are actually selected in the ORN, and how the monoallelic exclusion comes. So we have all of these receptors, and yet a single cell has to select one out of it, has to express that, okay, which is the monoallelic exclusion. And it seems that there's at least 3 or 4 different processes involved in selecting this gene, and it also seems that some of them are deterministic. For instance, how to choose a receptor gene according to an expression zone, and some of the others are stochastic. And so it's been thought that the deterministic rules may be very important within these zones, within the epithelium, which I realize now, well, they were posited as 4 zones, but it's becoming a more complex story, right? With maybe there's some overlapping or whatever. But the story originally is 4 zones, and the deterministic rules of the expression is important to select which subset of the receptors are expressed within a particular zone. And then the stochastic rules here are used to express between that subset randomly within a zone. Okay, so it's kind of nice that maybe although we've only done a study here where we're showing that we want to flip a coin to different sensory dimensions, it's kind of nice that we can get the optimal result by maybe having stochastic processes to basically make an overall good encoding of the stimulus.
This is what
you can go and look at this. It's kind of a summary of lots of different experiments in genetics here. But this is a nice review paper. You can go and look to see explaining the different principles. But it seems to be at least 3 steps involved in how feedback is used to basically select one of these genes and then suppress the other genes to make sure only one gets selected stochastically, but also to make sure that it's from the right subset within a particular zone. And these zones are going to become important later because we're going to exploit this story here when we think about time. So it's actually what I'm interested in is maybe we can make a better electronic nose by exploiting these tunings in this way. Okay, right.
You mentioned just sort of the understanding now, as you said, is it's not quite zone. It's basically a continuum.
Right.
Any given one has some sort of a distribution with a peak and something.
But they like to be in this kind of area, but they're kind of restricted, but not as clearly delineated.
Well, they're restricted, but the neighboring ones are completely overlapping, as you said. So I think it's thought to be essentially a continuum. I think Sakano's data is the best evidence that it's essentially a continuum.
But I think some kind of deterministic rule like this is still at play. but because this is all geared by markers, chemical markers and stuff, because the OR receptors are actually secondary receptors for these basically placement markers. It's a whole story in itself, but that also guides the expression. Okay, but what about time? You know, we know time is very important, so I've ignored time completely. And of course, this potentially makes things a lot more complex. So we see here in the Nice Johnson and Leon database, this is obviously at the next stage, the olfactory bulb. We've got complex spatiotemporal patterns resulting from a number of mechanisms, resulting obviously from the neuron cell dynamics themselves, the noise in the system, but also the delivery of the chemicals to the receptor sheet. So that's kind of what I want to talk about in some detail, about how the stimulus actually gets here, what the time dynamics might be. But it would be very nice if we could formulate, we've got a sort of formulation here in space, but can we extend that to formulate to capture some of this time information as well? No more slides. It's created like 5,000 slides for some reason.
I assume you go through all of these, right?
Yeah.
Lunch and dinner.
Okay.
That's strange.
That is weird. Okay, so the delivery onto the epithelium is pretty crucial, right? And for many decades, this was kind of almost deliberately ignored because it was too complicated, and olfactory coding was almost exclusively considered to be this population code of the tunings of the receptors themselves determining the code, and not the complexity of the delivery of the signal to the epithelium. And there was only really, I guess, one or two people, and Max Moselle was one of them, who for decades had pushed the hypothesis that the timing of the delivery of the chemical, especially for mixtures, was very important in different parts of the olfactory system. And this was sort of too difficult to really deal with. And but he showed various evidences early on, and now it's sort of had a bit of a renaissance. There's about quite a few papers in the last 5 years that have sort of shown more evidence for this effect. And so what actually happens? How does this actually work? Well, this is in a mouse nose. The main flow, airflow during inspiration is up here to a central region in blue at the top. This is a coronal section. Basically, the odor is delivered mainly to these areas as the animal sniffs in. This is the central area. Intriguingly, this is a zone which is expressing most of the non-volatile compounds, the highly soluble compounds, the fish oil type receptors, which basically responding to highly soluble compound that like to be in the liquid phase. And then as the sniff takes place, then basically there are flow within these turbinates to these other areas where it's also been shown in these other zones where the different classes of receptors are residing. And they've been shown to be much more responsive to hydrophilic compounds or less volatile compounds. And so it makes a kind of nice story about how for some types of compounds, you might want to be a certain type of zone of expression in other types in other areas. Now, in this area, if we look at these turbinates, there's a few interesting aspects of this. There's a paper a couple of years ago that has some very complex CFD simulations of these, of what happens in time and chemicals during the flow. But basically, in these regions here, we have nice lamina. We have nice lamina flow, so there's less chance for mixing in these turbulent regions. And so at least one idea is that because there's less mixing with this turbulent type flow, we could preserve the local structure more accurately for what the space-time information is in these regions as it flows through them. Clearly, if we look back at this data set 500 slides ago, we have both the convolution of all of this time information of a SNF going on to these different regions, together with the complexity of the olfactory epithelium, which is all around here. Basically, all this red and blue is all olfactory epithelium where these are expressed.
So what are the time scales? What's the difference between the time of the first response and the last response?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Seconds, or?
What could you say? Maybe 10 or 20 milliseconds, something of that order, across the on time for these areas compared to here. There was early evidence, this one of the papers with Max Mosel early on, that in fact this effect may be important for perception because these are the primitive sort of activity recordings on the epithelium in humans, depending upon whether we puff directly down on the sheet or have retronasal olfaction going this way or orthonasal olfaction going this way. And they found sort of different evidences for different types of responses according to which direction the odor is coming, right? Which may give us a clue about the importance of the delivery in this system. But it's worth saying in humans, we don't really get this effect very much because we don't have very complex turbinates like the beautiful turbinates you saw there for the mouse. So we'd like to model this as a sort of engineering system. So the first approach to doing that, we could do a complex CFD, but we wouldn't necessarily learn very much about it analytically. But because these areas are laminar, we could just consider these as a kind of channel and then try to make some maths for it, right? If we deliver a signal, a puff in this area, we'll see if we can make a channel for it and see what properties it might have. So that's basically what we did. Just take one of these channels and we basically put a puff into it, into a carrier flow. So this is our carrier flow due to the lungs and the pressure here, the negative pressure drawing this across. And we could put a mixture in here. So this would be our mixed chemical compound of bacon or whatever we put in here. And we're also going to assume that this is a stationary phase. So it's coated with a stationary phase, and I didn't say in the last slide, which I should have, is that the mucus is very important because it determines, it basically retards the pulse. So basically, as we have an odor going through here, the proportion, which are called the mass distribution coefficients, K, of which it's either hydrophilic, in which case it wants to be in the air phase, or hydrophilic, it wants to be in the stationary phase. And exactly like a GC or gas chromatograph, basically the compounds within the mixture that are more hydrophilic, they basically stay longer in the stationary phase, and so they get retarded. So there's a slower, although the carrier flow is this flow, the actual flow of the individual compounds is not the same velocity. They're moving at different velocities according to their affinity for the liquid phase. And this is interesting for olfaction because although the diffusion coefficient, which determines the spreading of these pulses as we sample them, is very similar for odors, the solubilities are incredibly different. So the solubility parameters of the whole molecule is very variable across individual compounds. So this idea of using chromatographic effect, and that was basically...
So that equates to more solubility.
It comes, it's basically going to be these K parameters.
An equation though. Is it R in terms of solubility?
No, it's actually, it's basically this V here.
V is velocity?
Yeah, V is going to be the velocity. And that velocity is going to depend upon the ratio of these mass distributions K. It's going to change according to that. So you've got this is the convection diffusion equation. But you can solve it, luckily within this case, with the boundary conditions, it just comes down to a nice diffusion equation with a moving reference frame where the velocity is determined by these mass distribution. And basically we get an analytical solution. So you might be able to imagine what happens to these pulses as we go through here. They start off as a square pulse, so basically you can use a Green's function.
In the
to solve this, but basically Green's function means that very quickly it falls into a Gaussian, travels along here, and they're moving at different speeds according to the solubility with this surface. So this is basically analytical solution for that equation with two analytes in a mixture, where one analyte is much more, analyte B is much more soluble, so it likes to stay in the liquid phase, so it gets slowed down, whereas basically the other analyte likes to be in the air phase, so it speeds up. So it's kind of a nice idea for technology, right? If we take a mixture, we could sort of segment them. We could take a sort of spectrum of these complex mixtures and try to basically get the information at different points. So we can think about, for instance, if I'm a particular sensor with a particular set of tunings, where would I like to position myself along here? So if I've got a receptor with the noise properties and particular tunings to the different ligands, I might want to position myself in different places, right? And
it used to be that the speed should be the same because it's the air speed, right?
The carrier is going to be faster than either of these, so there's a carrier speed which will be quicker than either of those, and basically, obviously, it can't go any faster than that, but it will be retarded by the.
And the solubility is in the boundary conditions, right? So that equation.
Now, the solubility is just basically worked out directly from these Ka and Kb, so it just tells you what this velocity will be for that component. So the component, this Va here, will determine for that component basically how fast it's going to go.
In terms of setup, you have the same, the V0 is the same for both components, right?
Sorry?
In the equation, speed is the same for both components, right?
But this is only considering one, this is just one pulse of one compound. So if you have two compounds, you have to do this separately.
No, I don't sense. In diffusion equation, you have the term that is basically responsible for carrying the compounds with the medium.
Yeah.
I don't understand why they have different velocities there.
Well,
medium is the same. It's just motion of system of reference, right?
There's two different things. So there's one thing is the diffusion, which is basically governs the spread. Okay. Basically, the spreading of the pulse as it moves along is governed by the diffusion, and the velocity of the movement is governed by the solubility, the relative solubility. The two independent.
I disagree with that. I think the velocity is the same.
Because of the carrier.
Because you basically are moving to a system of reference, which is the system of reference moving with the air. Yeah. There will be diffusion equation without the.
I might agree with you, except we built one and we fitted these equations and they fit very well.
So like many equations fit,
Well, you'll see anyway. Would be right. But basically, it fitted. These equations fit very well with what's happening in the thing that we built, with different velocities according to the different compounds. So there's a chromatographic. Otherwise, there's no chromatographic separation, right? There needs to be.
Because you have boundary conditions.
Maybe the boundary conditions are important. I mean, in the thing that we built, it's a sort of, you can consider it as an infinite length. So maybe the boundary conditions are kind of different in this system to the setup, yeah. But what we really want to do is we want to characterize this.
One last question. Yeah. It's also only an X, right? There's no Y basically in your.
No, for now we just consider this as a one-dimensional channel. So we're just considering one of these little areas. Because the reason why we can do that is because experimentally there's some sort of laminar effect here. So if we have a single laminar channel, it may have some relationship. But it's also because we're going to build that thing.
You have this air, the middle part of the tube, and you have the layer tube, whatever it's called, the liquid layer, I guess.
Yeah.
So at least you would need two equations for your C, right?
No, I mean, we're considering this just as one-dimensional, so this is very narrow tube. It's the same equation that's used really in GC analysis, so it all comes from GC.
Your subset A is the...
So you don't really need...
Yeah. You have two concentrations, right? You have A and S.
This is only the equation for one chemical. One chemical, but you have another one of these for the second chemical B.
No, not for the chemical, but for the different layers. So, but
oh, I think you no, you don't. Yeah, you just assume this is an arrow. So it's not determined by the distance here, because what's more important is the distribution coefficient. So in GCs or whatever, they never model this Y.
So is there a temporal decay? As it gets absorbed, or it gets absorbed in really?
Okay, that's a good question. So in this expression, it gets sort of much obviously sort of nonlinear and so on if we have some leaks, right? So if we assume that in the biological system, maybe these are absorbed into the mucosa or something, it's a different story.
So you have no leaks, so there's no temporal decay.
Well, the thing we're going to build, we're going to make sure that what goes in comes out. So there's no sinks in the system.
So presumably it's just an absorption and re-emission.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it goes in here, this is what retards it, basically, because it likes to be in here, but eventually it comes out again.
Goes in, and a little bit later it comes out with the delay, right? So it's not actually traveling with the carrier. It disappears for a while, stays there, and then comes back out.
Well, I mean, the setup of equations is...
standard.
I just don't understand the setup of equations.
No, but they're just standard GC equations. Anyway, I can show you. So, but what we would like to do is we would like to characterize these patterns, right? So we've got these different patterns. So clearly we've got a third mechanism for information here, right? Because we started with a pulse with mixed compounds all overlapping, convoluted. Now we're separating them. So in terms of the information about the individual components, we've got more information, right? Because we've done some segregation. We've segregated the components in some way or another. So we would like to characterize, how could we characterize the information given the fact that we've created these sort of patterning effects across the mucosa? And Manuel basically extended the Fisher information to using basically a stochastic time process, where now the sensor response will be a vector of the time series, which on a particular trial will be some sort of mean trial response, but on an individual trial it will be basically perturbed by some noise process. This might be Ornstein-Uhlenbeck or some random noise process that creates a random walk along a repeatable time trial. So if we have to assume some noise process, depending on the correlation of that noise and time and so on, we can basically try to basically use this to extend the Fisher information with time on this assumption. But we would need to know what the noise process is over time in order to do it. There's a paper I can show you how this is done, but basically, and it all works. As long as it's linear, everything has to be linear.
So in biological systems, how much does it actually spread relative to the width?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the one thing to say is that the diffusion constants will all be very similar, so there won't be much difference in the spreading.
But what's the difference in velocities relative to...
Yeah, I think you could say at least a few orders of magnitude differences in the solubility, so you would expect quite a big variation. Because if you look at solubilities for different compounds in a lipid phase, they vary quite a lot, but the diffusion doesn't much. So you'd expect a similar sort of decay, but you would expect different velocities along
the way. The distances are millimeters, right?
Yeah, that's also true.
And how far is it spread? What's the width?
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't worry about if it spreads a millimeter, then you don't gain anything, right?
Yeah.
It's spreading much smaller than a millimeter. separate them.
Yeah, it's something that we should estimate. I haven't estimated. It's an obvious thing to estimate because, let's say, how much, how reasonable is it within the time of a sniff? So if we have this measure, what we can do is we can take these parameters and play with them. So we can look at things like flow speed. So as we have different flow speeds through the channel, we could ask questions like, if we have different diffusion coefficients, which is different amounts of spreading, where should we be located to get the best estimate of the stimulus? So that's basically what these are. So we just rerun the Fisher information, the total Fisher information, but in this case it's just one sensor. So we have a single sensor responding to a single compound. So this is like the simplest situation. We just have one pure compound coming through, spreading, and it has a certain velocity, and that velocity is with respect to also the carrier flow. So we have an overall carrier flow, and it's either retarded or not according to its affinity for the liquid phase. And we would like to know where should we put our position of the sensor with a particular tuning. So if we have a particular tuning to the stimulus, which is characterized by the Fisher information as well, where should we position ourselves for a particular flow? So, for instance, does the flow matter? And for sensor locations very close to the inlet, we still pretty much have a square pulse. We don't have much diffusional spreading. And so the flow speed has less effect. But further away, we have more spreading. And so the flow effect, we seem to find, at least with these, or the intuition might be that you might want to have different flow speeds to optimally separate the odor. So it might be that, and this particularly becomes relevant when you've got mixtures. You might want certain flow speed in order to separate them according to which sensor you are at a particular location. So if I have a particular tuning for discriminating or estimating one component compared to the other, I might want to position myself and I might want to have a certain optimal flow speed.
Is this Fisher information average over time?
This can be, although we can either look at individual time slices, because it's local, as Bill said, we could look at time slices, or we could accumulate over the time, which is what we'll do at the end. We could also look at the tunings or the position of two sensors. So this is a bit like it's basically optimizing. So we could use the same measure to optimize where we should be in the channel for a particular discrimination or estimation task. So imagine we have two sensors with a two-component mixture going through. So we've got two components going through the channel. We've got the sensitivities to them are very similar. So the first sensor has a coefficient 1 and 0.9 for the second compound, whereas this one has 0.9 and 1. They're opposite, but 0.9 and 1. So slightly different tunings to these two compounds as they go through them. And we can consider the cases of whether we have similar diffusion or different diffusions. And basically, you can use this measure to work out where we should be to optimally estimate both of the compounds. Or we could just be interested in one, but this is like the total, so we've added them together. But we could be interested in, what say we're interested in one compound compared to ignore the others and so on. There's basically different games we can play, but what we see is that clearly the position is important, right? So it's not basically if you have a particular sensor tuning, you have particular noise properties, where you are in this channel makes a difference. So could we actually use this, you know, to build it? So they basically build a system using some of these ideas. So you might know that these electronic nose technologies, you know, for many years are basically use time in a pretty primitive way. So you put a bunch of sensors there, you put your square pulse on, and you might have a second mechanism of temporal responses in the sensors, but you haven't got any segregation due to channels or whatever. So you just put all of the complex mixture onto the surface, you might get some different due to the sensor kinetics mainly. So depending upon the kinetics in the sensor, you may get some nice different temporal responses. And as you'd expect, you'd get some sort of population code, like we started off with at the start of the talk, so some sort of time invariant measure where we ignore time. So you've got two mechanisms there. So this is basically what's being used in, say, commercial systems. So you go and buy one of these systems, they're basically what they're doing. Put on a pulse here, extract a fingerprint. Maybe some of the more expensive ones looking at some time response to get a little bit more information.
How many sensors do you typically have?
Might have 12 sensors, not many of different types. And if you look at the PCA or the Scree plotter, they tend to be very highly correlated responses, so there's not much difference. Ideally, you want to use different sensor technologies and stuff in here to increase the dimensionality of the system. So, but what we want to do is take these sensors and put them within a microchannel. So basically try and make what we call an artificial mucosa. So in this case, we basically put the, in this case, these will be polymer sensors. We're going to put the same, they're going to have the same tunings. We're going to put blocks of them at different points along the channel. So we can, for instance, listen to the sensor with the same tuning in different positions to see how it can basically extract different parts of the spectra as it moves along there. So it's a bit like a bacillar membrane or something in the auditory system where, you know, different frequency components are being picked up at different points. And you would like to know lots of things about this, right? So you'd like to know, so what flow rate should I use to optimally separate? Where should I be? So if I'm this particular sensor with this particular tuning, where should I be positioned? And so on. What sort of kinetic should I have? Because obviously the speed of the sensor is crucial, right? If we have a slow sensor here, the pulse will have just gone, and we may not have even had much chance to respond with it within the background of the noise. So this sensor kinetics are also something that need to be optimized. So we've got many parameters within the system, but if we can optimize them using this Fisher information, then we can make a much better technology. So this is this third mechanism. So you've got these sort of first two mechanisms in this in these commercial systems. And only more recently, I mean, our paper where we built this and a lot of other sensor papers have started exploiting this mechanism as well, right? So this third mechanism where we can get some segregation of the stimulus to get extra temporal information through separating complex mixtures.
How do you do implement this different solubility effect?
Yeah, I mean, basically we just use a stationary phase similar to use on a GC. You could imagine making these with different stationary phases that would all have different affinities for different groups of compounds as they do in GC. It's kind of, it's basically, as you can see, a hybrid between a GC and an electronic nose, right? But you, like you said, you want to try and make it fast, which you'll see that this first one that we built was not fast, right? Because it had to be very long. So actually, Peter's is a really great question because how do we make this work within the context of the time of a sniff, right, is a key thing. So how do we build it? Well, we use a 3D printer. This is a stereolithography set up to build a 3D micro package. And basically what you do is you get your sensor array on a surface, on a circuit board, and then this package allows us to have very long 1D channel that goes along here, but it, at various intermittent points, interacts with the sensors, so the identical sensors along the channel at different points, right? So this is our artificial mucosa, and I can talk to you about the sensors, but basically they're each polymer sensors. We use different cations within the polymers to get different tunings, so we can use a variety of different cations to make basically change the population tuning of these, and to some extent this changes the kinetics as well. Because we see here, these are just without any microchannel or whatever, we just expose the odor and we see that immediately they already have different temporal information according to the same stimulus, normalized. This is, so they also have different heights of response. So they already have this mechanism too, but now we want to put them within this channel in order to get more out of them. So just for reference, these are with the particular compounds that are used. What's the effect of the mucosa? What does the mucosa do? Well, we can put the same thing through through a system without without any stationary phase, so we have it uncoated. You'll still get some diffusional spreading, of course, along the length, but you won't get any of this solubility retarding effect. So there's no retarding of the stim. So basically, this is at the inlet. You get a nice defined pulse as your green functions are starting to separate out. And then at the outlet, you've got your diffusional spreading. But you don't have any differences in retarding between toluene and ethanol, right? So they come out at the same time. But when you put the coating in there, because of the differences in solubility, you now get this extra time information in the system, which gives you a spectrum of data to exploit. So there's coating. But as you see, right, so 250 seconds to make it a bit faster. This was a lot to do with the pressures and the lengths we had to make to get it through the system with the stationary phases and so on. So what happens when we look at all the polymers? Well, basically, if we have ethanol here and toluene here, you can see we get tremendously different fingerprints in time. It's like a time signature of a different molecule according to the retarding, the particular tuning, the noise in the sensor, and so on. So you've got these three parameters at play. There's a long story I can show you in the paper, but we need to, in order to apply the Fisher information, we have to show it's linear. So we had to look at these responses for mixtures. So when we put toluene and ethanol together, what happens? And we looked at the responses for the individual compounds and then the mixtures, showed that this was very close to linear behavior. So that was good for us to be able to apply, otherwise we wouldn't have been able to use our measure at all. So it's lucky that it came out that way. We also applied our equation. You saw there, so this was our equation fitted with these parameters to these for the different sensors according to the retarding and spreading of the chemical signal. So this was the prediction from the equation. Once we fit the parameters, then we predict. So it had a very good prediction of what the sensor response will be. So we're basically modeling two things here. We fitted the sensor as just a difference between two exponentials, so a very simple first-order kind of model, exponential model, fit the sensors, then use the equation from the microchannel to predict what the response from the sensor will be when we convolve both things together, drive one with the other. And we get a good prediction of what the sensor response is doing at different points in the channel. So it's our formula to then calculate this for the channel. So we can take a time series and basically take that equation that we showed before, take the time series like we saw here for the sensors, and then apply that to calculate the total Fisher information across all the sensors and at different times. So we can either take a time slice, but also accumulating all the information up until that point. So we can ask the question, after this amount of time, what's our accuracy of being able to estimate the stimulus? And the solid line is the low error with when we use space and time information, and the dashed is where we only use space information. So we only use the tunings. So these are the tuning case. This is when we use the tunings with the spatial responses as well. And as you might expect, we've got a proof that, you know, if you use the space and time, you're never going to do worse than just the tuning. So you're always going to do better using this extra third mechanism. It's just a question of how much you're going to do better. And in this case, we got just a small improvement. If we push it with a simple task, we just want to estimate a concentration of toluene and ethanol in a mixture. We put a mixture through the channel. We want to estimate both of the components. How well can we do? Well, we only do three times better.
Is that permanent square error?
It's the total, yeah.
So the standard deviation is the square root of that, right?
Yeah, yeah. But if we face it with a more complex task, like we put through a complex odor through it with many compounds, like an essential oil with peppermint and various other stuff in there, or some vanilla ice cream flavor or whatever, which is a much more challenging task with many spectral components and so on, we find as we push the system, so if you demand more from the system, then you should expect a better estimate because you've got much more complex stimulus and so on. So you would expect that time segregation to be important. Okay, so how does this relate to biology, right? So I've gone on this sort of nerdy technical thing. But coming back to try and close the story, I mean, there were some intriguing aspects, right? So there's this new theory, I guess, well, it's 10 years old now, this zonation idea. You've probably heard of zonation. And the idea of zonation is that, so this is in Tom Cleland's and Schoenfeld's paper. Basically, this is the inlet for nodu at the top of the nose in rat or mice of these turbinates. As the inspiration of the signal goes across these, we've got these zone sort of expression zones for the different receptors. And the idea that Tom called at that time zonation was the idea in different behavioral contexts. Maybe we can change the sniffing strategy to direct certain compounds or subsets of compounds of interest to particular parts of this receptor sheet. Right? That was the zonation strategy. It's a bit of a shame Leslie Kay isn't here, because she did a paper a couple of just 2 years ago that showed evidence behaviorally in the animals that basically this zonation strategy may be something that's actually used in animals. So exploiting this kind of time information may be important. And we can obviously play the same games as we did in the technology. Can we play the same games in the biology to try and understand how to adapt the flow, how to adapt the sniffing profile, and maybe work out, maybe even predict what types of tunings we should have in different positions according to such a system? And there are now, you know, we don't have to rely on our 1D microchannel model anymore, because there are very nice papers with complex CFD 3D models and so on to show how this stuff separates in space in such a structure. But it's also good and reassuring to see that these different zones of expression are also preserved in the olfactory bulb, right? So the way it works is that this central region is where the odors come in, and this is where most of the olfactory receptors tend to be expressed. In the class 1 expressors, there's something like 80% of the majority of the receptors are in this central region, and the remainder of them are in these peripheral regions, so this central and peripheral regions. And this mapping of this central to peripheral is very well preserved onto the olfactory bulb. So depending upon the dorsal and the ventral areas, according to these different regions basically being mapped. So at least the information is not lost. So it opens the question of mapping these areas onto the processing, whether, for instance, can you predict olfactory bulb responses? Can you predict something about the neural processing as a result of this type of mapping? So just to finish up, what could we do? So I brought this up again. It's sort of embarrassingly old. Some of this stuff's embarrassingly old. But I sort of brought it up because I think maybe it could make some interesting links between building technological systems and what we might be able to say about strategies in biology. So as we've seen in the technology which I emphasized on, you know, we can obviously try to optimize sensor kinetics to make sure we capture the information at the appropriate time, noise responses, sensitivities, spatial location, profile of the odor pulse and so on, what the carrier flow is. We can even use these to make optimal classifiers or linear classifiers for what the readout and learning strategy should be to extract the different components of information. But maybe more interestingly in the biology is, for example, could we use such a measure to apply to the olfactory system to maybe predict receptor zones? Could it say something about what a sniffing strategy needs to be for particular behavioral tasks? Could we link it with psychophysics through the initial measure of the inverse of this matrix? Could it tell us something in certain cases about the psychophysical limits? Are there some aspects of the Leon maps that we saw in the olfactory bulb that might be predictable in terms of the zonation story? And what about evolution of the receptor classes and so on? Is there something we can say about that in terms of their tunings to the world and why some of them need to be centrally located and some of them peripherally located? And what can we say about how this might constrain or otherwise subsequent neural processing? So what does it tell us about how we might extract this information? And finally, if there is such a thing as zonation, what should be the optimal strategy for how to change your sniff profile in terms of some task? So is there some strategy here that we should be able to say with these flow equations and so on? So I hope by at least having a measure, now it may not be what the final olfactory system is interested in, because it's certainly throwing away a lot of this information, but at least at the receptor point, it may make sense in terms of thinking about building the representations, that it might be able to help with some of these points. Okay, so I should thank Manuel, who helped with the spatiotemporal information measures, and also Julian Gardner's group, and James Covington, who built the microchannel that I showed you. Thanks.
I wonder, like, in terms of the channel, how well actually does it work? Like, can it distinguish different types of beer? Or
That would probably kill it, right? Imagine putting through these sticky molecules. Yeah, I think that was one of the things that dissuaded them, probably putting these sticky molecules. You probably have to throw it away afterwards. We need more measurements. Right? But it's clear that it works better in complex stimuli.
What's the advantage over a conventional gas chromatograph?
Like Peter said, I mean, with a GC system, well, you've got two things, really. So what happens in a GC? You've got different things that happen in a GC, but one approach is just to have a PID detector, which doesn't care about mass that comes on the output. So you never get any information about the chemical construction. You only get peaks. And so you have to wait like an hour or something. So if you have even if you do a coffee through a GC, you might have to wait 2 or 3 hours to do a very slow ramping temperature profile to get out the different components slowly. And you need to get them out slowly enough so that you can discriminate the peaks.
So speed is it?
So, you know, clearly using a strategy like this, you want to try and make a hybrid where you've got the thing fast and optimal to use the tuning information of the receptors to try and get the task that you're trying to solve. So I think, but also you can see how much flexibility it gives you, right? Because you're then free to work out how should I deploy my tunings according to what my task is. And so it's not necessarily the task that we want to estimate the accuracy of every concentration. It's probably not the task, right? So we've got to define what our task is, and we can use the Fisher information or function of the Fisher information to then say, if this is our task, for instance, segmenting one complex odor in the background of another, then it can tell us. And it's something very difficult to do with the GC, because even when the peaks separate out, they can be mixed and convolved, right? But you don't necessarily have the information about the different components in each.
Often you need multiple columns to get a good separation.
Yeah, exactly.
So it seems like a big problem, like you say, is stickiness of these molecules. I mean, how long before you can build artificial noses that like basically not get clogged up? Is that possible? Like, smell beer and not get clogged up?
Well,
nothing about this field. I'm just
look at this. I mean, these reasonably reversible, right? Well, long time, but yeah. this is within the channel, so it's not like there are some sticking around, but it obviously depends which compounds you use. This is highly volatile, so it's not going to stick, right?
So there's some things that are sick and are really hard to get rid of?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, pheromone molecules, that's exactly why they're designed to stick to things, right? You'll never get rid of them. So
it's all the artificial nurses don't smell pheromones.
Yeah, no, it's a very hard problem, pheromones, yeah. Yeah, but no, it's a good point, right? But, I mean...
You cover the end and you last forever.
So, yeah, I mean, it depends. For highly volatile compounds, pretty reversible, and it all depends on the technology you're using. Some of these sensors are just awful, right? Just really noise, low signals, some of them better than others.
So what about using live cells and culturing them?
Yeah. A lot of people have. In fact, we've got another story where we've used insect receptors and SF9 cells, expressed them, and basically measure them on the surface acoustic wave thing, where we measure the frequency changes and stuff. Various groups are doing that for different receptor proteins. People like Joel Mainland, I mean, he's got an assay, right, to measure from huge varieties. The problem is time, and the fact that, you know, if you're trying to make a reproducible system, the robustness and stability, you know, I mean, it's a cell, right? It's just dying as soon as you put it on there. So.
You want a cage full of mice?
Yeah. In fact, that's exactly what they're going to do at airports, right? Did you read the story where they're going to put cages of mice in the airports?
They have dogs already, so
that's a pretty good thing.
But you're not going to see the mice that are going to take your sample of your suitcase or whatever there?
They'll crawl around the luggage.
Isn't that the best?
On a wheel or something.
The best machine detector were these insects, right? Where this Japanese group put them on robots.
Kanzaki.
Exactly,
yeah. The bees are good. I mean, there's groups. There's a company in UK called Sentinel that trains the bees for explosive detection for landmines. So they managed to successfully train them to find landmines pretty well. I mean, they make a living from it, so I guess it must work. And you know, people doing, yeah, you can put a whole antenna and take an EAG or whatever. But it's always stability, you know. And it's also sensitivity, you know. It's also sensitivity is the other key thing. I mean, nothing can touch, say, a moth or a dog nose. It's also why we've got this incredible number of receptors, right, and convergence and so on that we see in this system here. I mean, where the receptors are expressing, it's taking up like 50% of the nasal volume, just crammed full of hundreds of millions of these receptors and integrating all the information. So
whatever happened to all this sort of polymer detectors, right? I mean, people like John Cowher and all the people.
I mean, these are polymers. They're just not, John, no.
But you were measuring voltage, right? I mean, I'm thinking.
He looked at optical.
Borrow the DNA.
Looked at optical.
Fluorescence, right? Fluorescence changes.
Yeah, there's lots of optical ones. Do you
have a sense for why they didn't go, they're just not good enough? Is that why? Or just people didn't work on it? Because, yeah, the point is that it's the DNA technology, people have, you know, Illumina, how many units do they sell, right, for heaven's sake?
Well.
You can somehow hijack that.
I think a type of optical technology is probably going to be the holy grail of this, they're starting to play with these quantum dots now, where you might even get to the point of being able to detect single molecules through.
Yeah, but you need to transduce the thing. I think the point is that how do you couple the emission to?
Yeah.
I think quantum dots it's pretty easy to get. Well, pretty easy as long as it's in 2 degrees Kelvin, right? You get very good. So the idea is not the binding, but
no, I think the point is that you're saying, I think the fluorescence, I don't think it's really the rate limiting. I mean, we can do very well.
Another really rate limiting thing is if you a super sensitive receptor will be generally very high affinity, right? So the amazing problem that the olfactory system solves is it has this amazing sensitivity to this huge variety of compounds with low affinity receptors that basically means it can unbind them and terminate the signal. And if you can't terminate the signal, you're screwed, right? So basically, if you try and engineer a system, often you end up building these super high affinity receptors, which have great sensitivity, but you can never get back. So I think a phenomenal way to think of the phenomenal capability of the olfactory system is that it combines all these low affinity solution, but yet still packs in lots of sensitivity and reversibility of binding and all this stuff.
Seems like we should put a whole bunch of crappy sensors and do a combination of recording, no? Seriously.
Yeah. Well, basically what engineers have been doing for the last 40 years, I mean, we haven't been able to make specific sensors, which is exactly why we've been looking at the olfactory system, because of our inability to make decent, specific and sensitive. So basically the strategy has been throw it all in and let machine learning take care of it or whatever, right?